Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're talking theater today and talking about an immensely exciting and meaningful project that is taking shape right up the road from us at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. It is the mounting of a play called Boswell, and a performance that will not only occur at Parkside this coming Saturday at 4:30, but then a performance that will occur at the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh. And this is an incredibly exciting undertaking for everybody involved, and in particular for the 4 people who are my morning show guests today to talk about it. We have, first of all, Dr. Leslie Walker, who is Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And all of this, in a sense, is happening under the auspices of that division. And Dean Walker has been a tireless champion of this and other special projects. Brian Gill is with us. He's been on the morning show before as well, assistant professor of performance in the theater arts department at Parkside, and he is co-director of this production and acting in it, if I understand correctly.
Just acting.
Oh, you're not co-directing.
No, I get to just be an actor this time.
I'm sure I saw co-director written someplace, but okay. I stand corrected. You are co-director,
yes,
with somebody else, and I thought it was with Brian. So I will cross off all the questions I was going to ask about what is it like to direct yourself as an actor. So I guess we don't have to ask you that today anyway. So Brian Gill, who is part of the cast of Boswell, as is another Brian who's sitting right next to him, Brian Mani, who is a professional actor with the theater arts, with the American Players Theater in Spring Green. And I'm sure many listeners have been there and probably seen Brian Mani on the stage. He is in the cast of Boswell as well. And finally, last but certainly not least, is the playwright responsible for this play, Marie Kohler. And we've spoken to her before about another work of hers, Midnight in Mall Flanders, which was done at Parkside. And we'll be talking with her about this play, which actually first took shape some years ago, and she has revised for this production. She is the co-founder and resident playwright of the Renaissance Theater Works. And so, 4 talented people, 4 excited people in the room. We welcome all 4 of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have all of you here. So, Dean Leslie Walker, let's begin with you, and tell us beyond anything that I neglected to say, just what this project entails and also how it took shape.
Thank you so much, Greg. We're so happy to be here this morning. So this project really got underway, I would say probably in the early 2000s, because Brian Gill and Marie Kohler have been working together for about that length of time. So I believe that Boswell was done originally in 2005.
That's correct.
And so they had a chance to work together back in 2005. In, Brian, you're going to have to help me, I'm going to say 2015, Brian joined the staff at UW Parkside.
Yes, I think that's right. 14, 15?
Yeah, 2014, 15. And he's brought with him some amazingly innovative ideas. And these ideas have been to work with Marie, a living, breathing playwright, which is something that the students don't always get the opportunity to do. So this all got started. We first actually did a staged reading in our Fresh Ink series of Boswell. And at that point, it was called Boswell's Dreams, I believe.
I am not sure what we called it at that point. I think it was Boswell, because I think we were then beginning to shift towards the possibility of taking this forward. But I'm not 100% on that, Leslie.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll do our archival research and get back with you on that one. But so we did this back 2 years ago in 2016 as part of a series that we do at Parkside called Fresh Ink. And it was that point, I think, that the alchemy started brewing. And I think that Marie and Brian started talking maybe about the idea of reproducing, remounting this play in view of maybe taking it to the Edinburgh Fringe mm-hmm. Festival. And so we, Parkside, hopped on Marie's bandwagon. And so I want to make it clear that this project is being driven by the Marie Kohler Productions, and we are a sort of junior partner in the project, but we are a very proud junior partner. We're super excited for our students. We'll have four students participating, two student actors, and then two tech students are working on the play right now. The whole crew is at Parkside during the month of July, and they are in rehearsal 5 days a week. I'm super impressed by their hard work during the month of July. So, and we've worked together, like I said, as a sort of junior partner to the Marie Kohler production, and we are just excited to be part of that, and we are excited that our students are going to have this extraordinary opportunity not only to work with professional theater people, but also to spend 3 weeks in Edinburgh participating in a play themselves, as well as getting a chance to see all of the amazing, there are over 3,000 performances at the Fringe Festival. So, like I say, I'm super proud and excited about this project.
And excited for very, very good reason, that's for sure. Brian Gill, explain a little bit more about what Dean Walker was talking about in terms of when you began at Parkside, this general idea that you had about collaborations that could occur that would really enrich the program and especially the experience of Parkside Theater Arts students.
Sure, yeah. Once I was hired as faculty, one of the things that I wanted to do as quickly as possible was find ways to link the department with professional theater companies and to start building those relationships using relationships that I had been theater relationships that I've been involved in for a long period of time. So finding internships and trying to bring people in and just getting more opportunities for our students to work professionally. And I knew that with my past experiences with Marie, I thought, well, she'd be phenomenal to get into Parkside. And also, as Leslie mentioned, having a playwright in the room during the process is great. It's not what you usually get to do. You know, a lot of the plays that you do, the playwright isn't going to be there. So I was really excited at the idea of being involved in that process again, and for our students to be involved in that process. So I reached out to Marie and I said, you know, we've got this Fresh Ink series. How about we started with Midnight in Mall Flanders.
Yes, that's right.
I said, you know, what do you think about we do a stage reading of Midnight in Mall Flanders? And Marie was very excited about that. And so we did that. And then we talked about Boswell.
Mm-hmm.
And Marie was already starting to work on that play. And then I got an email from Marie that just said, Monty and I are thinking about, or Monty and I are going to take Boswell to Edinburgh. Are you in? ? Stared at my screen for a while.
Yeah, there's a lot wrapped up in those 10 words.
Yes. Marie started working on the play, and then those conversations started to begin. And we're very fortunate because Leslie's incredibly supportive of the department and what we are doing. So then we started to talk about it, and well, what if this could be? Because we have an internship with Renaissance Theatre Works, we've done for the last 2 years, and it's going to continue. We started talking about, well, what if, since Renaissance Theatre Works is involved, what if this could be kind of an internship situation, and what if we could have a couple of acting interns and a couple of technical interns, and then professors Jody Sikas and Misty Bradford. We expanded that conversation for Jody to design the set and the projections and the props, and Misty to design costumes, and then the original director of Boswell's Dreams, Norma Saldivar, who's now at UNLV, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Conversation going with them as well, and so it started to just become this big collaborative.
It's big.
Yeah, it's big. It is big. Who'd have thunk?
Yeah, nine-headed hydra.
Kind of. Sort of. Or ten-headed.
Yeah, right.
Ten-headed.
Yeah, maybe. And Brian, your collaboration with Marie Kohler, was it through Renaissance? Is that where the two of you met?
Yeah, I was a Chicago actor, and I got a call to audition for this new play that was being done up in Milwaukee with Renaissance Theater Works. So I drove up and auditioned for – I have since affectionately referred to them as my Renaissance ladies. and we all just kind of hit it off and had a really great time. And Marie and I had this weird thing where we both had a book called Boswell's Presumptuous Task. We both had a copy of it in our bags. The first time we met.
I thought, oh, he's my man.
and the rest is history. That was the beginning of our collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. For those of you just joining us, we are talking about an exciting project which is underway right now on the campus of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. It is the mounting of a production of Marie Kohler's play Boswell in a performance that will be coming up this Saturday afternoon at Parkside. And then that production is going to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh. And we've heard already from Brian Gill, Assistant Professor of Performance at Parkside, and Leslie Walker, who is Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities. Now we want to turn our attention to the playwright of Boswell, Marie Kohler, and to her husband, who is also a professional actor with American Players Theater, Brian Mani, who is, along with Brian Gill, in the cast of Boswell. And you're the co-director of this as well.
I am. Originally, Norma Saldivar, who directed the previous incarnation of Boswell's Dreams, was going to be the director for this, and she had some reasons that she needed to drop out, and we all agreed, just for her own sake, it was best that she do that to take care of her health and unexpected business. So we, Laura Gordon, who is in the cast, who's a good friend, an extraordinary actor and director all across the country, she's in the show, and she and I talked and said to ourselves, let's just do this together. So she and I are splitting the work of directing. Laura's also is also performing, and I'm also playwriting and producing. So it's we all wear more than one hat.
It's a busy room.
It's a very full room, a lot of work is getting done, and it's really, I must say, it's been very seamless, although it's a lot of work. It's entirely collegial and companionable. The room, as they say in theater, the room is terrific. It's lots of fun. There's been no roadblocks or no tension. We're just all kind of working like a well-oiled machine, students and professionals included. It's really kind of unbelievably great.
Fantastic. Well, I'm actually really anxious to talk with the two of you about your life together in the theater, but I want to delay that just a little bit.
Sure.
I think we need to dig into the play itself, and that means we need to dig into the life of one James Boswell.
Yes.
And I suspect a lot of our listeners are not going to be familiar with this name at all. So tell us, first of all, about who James Boswell was.
Well, James Boswell was a kind of a curious character in Scottish history. He was the son of the Laird of Auchinleck. So he came from landed gentry. His father was a very prominent man in the legal system, head magistrate of Edinburgh's Court of Law, Scotland's Court of Law. So he was a Scottish, well-born character, but very insecure and very at loose ends about what he wanted to do with his life. Did not have a great relationship with his father, who wanted him to stay in Scotland, follow in his footsteps, be a lawyer, take over the handling of the estate, you know, do the family thing, and for his cast in Scottish society. Boswell was drawn to the center of British culture at that point, which was London. So he kept wanting to drift away from what the father wanted him to do. And he came to London in search of what his path would be in life, and also in search of famous people. And his favorite famous person was a man named Samuel Johnson, who was probably more well known in the civilized world, as they called it, than anyone else, more well known and admired than King George III. He was an extraordinary intellect, and Boswell attached himself to him, met him by accident and by sheer perseverance, and the two of them became great and enduring friends. Eventually, Boswell found his calling by being Johnson's biographer. No one knew it at the time, but that became the source for his place in literary history. And it was considered the first true biography, and very much in what we now think of as a more modern style than most writers of that period. So in the meantime, during all of these years of escapades and adventure and traveling and trying to figure out who he was, he kept journals prodigiously. And those journals were not really discovered until the 20th century. They were kept under wraps by the family because they were very honest, very detailed, sometimes bawdy. And the family just, they kept stacking them up in their attics, and sometimes the attic material would move to another place. All these journals were spread out all over Britain and Europe, and they were finally discovered and put together between 1920 and 1950. So the play is about the rediscovery and the value, or, you know, who believes that they are value and who have value and who doesn't. So the play is about the emergence of those journals in the 20th century and what they meant. And I have invented an American academic woman named Joan Weinstein who comes upon them. She thinks she's looking for Samuel Johnson because he's the established literary figure, and she ends up kind of with her head turned towards Boswell, at first dismissing him and then taking in the value and worth of what this trove of journals represents. So there you go.
it's a terrific story. How closely do you align with the way in which these journals, in fact, were sort of rediscovered? I mean, how fanciful is your treatment of
it's that? Somewhat fanciful, but based on the kind of the overarching story. There were in real life, there were maybe 10 people involved with the discovery of these things and the collection of them, the acquiring of them, and they mostly ended up at Yale University, which is very famous for its Boswell collections. And in the 50s, Yale began spitting out these journals, really changing the course of literature, literary history. So I have not put her at Yale. I have set her in Chicago, and there were women involved in this historic search, but I've kind of taken the literary license of compressing them into Joan, who is someone I've invented, and I've also kind of created the lady who is the aristocratic descendant who's now responsible for these journals. And there were people like that too, but I've compressed them into this woman whom I've created. So I've kind of created parallel friendships between Johnson and Boswell in the 18th century, and Joan and Lady Fiona in the 20th century. So half of it is, some of it is invented, and some of it is true. But there's always a little bit of fitting the story to make it stage worthy and not exactly according to history.
Right. From what I understand of the summary of the play that I've read, this play is not just about the act of uncovering these journals, but the way in which these journals speak very powerfully, very potently to this woman doing this research. Tell us more about that.
Well, having come from a male-dominated academic system in the 20th century, for Joan Weinstein, she has been schooled that the more monumental figures of the Enlightenment, among them, the greatest among them, Samuel Johnson, were the focal points worthy of focus of attention. And she has to be encouraged by exposure to this new strange material and encouraged by Lady Fiona to consider it of worth.
And appreciate it.
Appreciate it. So it's kind of like, how do we define what's of value? Is it only according to what the past and a more patriarchal system has established? And she's dealing with her professor, who wants her to bring home the gold, bring home the Johnson. And she decides that actually this is more human. This is more not, it's less abstract, less authoritarian, less this is the way it is, and more, oh my gosh, look at these people having claret. Look at these people deciding to climb a really high hill. Detailed, I would say, kind of more feminine in its observational quality, more detailed, more in the moment, less enlightenment abstraction.
More personal.
More personal, that's the word. Personal and human scaled.
Right. Mm-hmm. I like that.
Mm-hmm. And an interest in the kind of domestic, right?
Yes,
right. And that, if you think of that,
thank you.
That sort of
the way people lived, the way people
lived
their lives.
Yes, I'm going to add all of your words into my play today. Today's my cutoff day for rewrites, so I'm going to grab some of them, throw them at the actors.
Right. So tell us about first of all, who is in the cast? You've already kind of outlined four principal people. Are there people in the play beyond that?
There are. Let me see. I think there are. Who's the number? There's probably about 10 to 12 incidental main and incidental characters. But the main ones are. We start with the three: Joan and the two travelers. And by the play's end, I think the lady has added herself to those ranks. But in addition to that, we meet the typical characters of Johnson's world, which would have been the great portrait painter Joshua Reynolds, Oliver Goldsmith, who wrote She Stoops to Count Her, David Garrick, who was the greatest actor of his era and arguably one of the greatest actors of all time. And then we have the more... Margaret Thrale, who was one of Johnson's friends and literary partners. And then we move to Scotland and we meet the people in the taverns and the more everyday types, the tavern, the carriage driver and the taxi man. And so it's a lot of smaller characters as well that... that this cast of is portraying.
And are we toggling back and forth between the present day?
Yes,
and
we toggle away. And it's very fun.
We toggle sometimes from one line to another. We will be rooted in the 18th century, and literally the next line is rooted in 1950.
Wow.
And by the same actor.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. By the taking off of a wig or the changing of a coat, just like that, we flip it. And it's theatrical, and we do it very deliberately and right in front of the audience. There's no hiding what we're doing. And it's exciting, and we hope the audiences find it exciting as well.
Oh, I should think it would be a tremendous challenge and fulfilling challenge for the actors, for sure.
The very first one, Laura Gordon... is Oliver Goldsmith, and she excuses herself from a tavern scene, and literally as she turns, begins speaking as David Garrick. And with the put on of a cape and the plopping of a hat at a precise moment, she is the actor David Garrick, having just left a performance of Hamlet. And there it is. It's going to be fun.
Wow. So who do the two of you portray? Or are you also portraying multiple roles in this?
Well, Brian Gill plays James Boswell.
That's true.
And just him.
That's enough.
He's got enough. I am playing Samuel Johnson, but I also make a couple of little appearances as James Boswell's father, who wants him to stick to law and not dally with scribbling and writing and all those fancy people in London. He wants him to stay at home. I also play a doctor that James Boswell needs to visit for a very special problem. And then I also portray the professor who is trying to keep Joan Weinstein on track with her studies and research.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking about the play Boswell with the playwright, Marie Kohler, with two members of the cast, Brian Mani, who happens to be Marie Kohler's husband, and Brian Gill from the faculty at Parkside. And also with us is Dean Leslie Walker, Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. This play will be presented this Saturday afternoon at Parkside. And then shortly thereafter, the company goes to the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh. And how exciting that will be to take this play with its Scottish themes to Scotland. Mm-hmm. So, Marie Kohler,
yes.
So this play first emerged some years ago, and it sounds like you have been sort of restlessly tinkering with it ever since.
Is that
sort of the way to describe it?
At intervals, yes. I discovered in my parents' great collection of books when I was a little girl in the 50s, early maybe 1960-ish, I grew up in a big house, and we had lots of books, and more books than people. And I would pass the time by exploring books in our library, and I remember pulling down a book with a great illustration on it of ladies and gents from the 18th century in gowns and breeches, and opening it up. I thought, oh, this looks interesting, and I opened it up, and there was a body scene taking place in an alley in London. I thought, what's this? My parents have left this out? So I went back to it, and it's just this wonderful, direct voice. I have, in all the plays I've written, which is about six now, I think, I often return to this journalistic eye, journal-based eye. I did this today, or today, you know, this happened, journal/diary. I find it riveting. It's as if you're hearing directly from this person's experience who lived in the past. And so I kind of held that in my mind. I was an English lit major in college, and though we didn't study Boswell in that day, we studied Johnson. But I held it in my head, and when I became playwright in residence at Renaissance Theatre Works, I thought, you know, I really think that all this journal stuff could be incorporated into a play. And they trusted me, for which I am eternally grateful. And we put it together. That was a much longer version, many more characters, many more actors. I think we had nine.
Yeah, that's right.
It was too big and too unwieldy to dream of taking to Scotland, so it seemed the best thing to compress it down and streamline its themes, and that's what I think we are doing to this, you know, to this very day. We are still stripping it away and trying to compress it, and I think it's a better script than it ever was. I think it's a more compelling and at the same time entertaining story. Sometimes pressures to make things short or small or less expensive bring about better art. That's an irony that I keep coming up against in my experience in theater, is sometimes the institutions that have the largest of budgets can get it sometimes loose and sloppy.
Right, bloated.
bloated, exactly. Yes. And you lose the muscle, the artistic muscle of working against constraint. So that's what we've got here. We've got constraint of time, budget, and space. In fact, we have a tiny stage that we'll be performing on.
16 by 11.
That we get stage. Maybe 3 hours?
We get three hours to rehearse on.
So we're talking about in Scotland
in
now.
In Scotland, yeah. Yes. We're reproducing it right now in the Black Box Theater at the Rita at UW Parkside.
So the dimensions of where you will perform this at the Fringe Festival, you are recreating in the Black Box Theater.
We have to in order to know
the
how
magic
to
of tape.
Yes. You tape it out
and sheets.
And yes. You tape it out and you stay within the taping, and then you have to reproduce the blocking, the staging.
Wow. I'm especially fascinated by that notion that constraint can be your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of people just kind of observing this from the outside and not really being a part of it probably can't even imagine such a thing being true. But
yes.
But in fact, it sounds like this is, in a sense, really enriched the work by the act of scaling it down, which is ironic.
Yeah, it is ironic. I don't think it's always the case that people respond in that way. But if you have really creative people, designers, Misty and Jody are fantastic. Laura's really great in terms of clever blending of characters and actors. So the actors have been extraordinarily creative. So I think we are boiling it down to a really dense, playful, fun, and not indulgent little production.
I like that as well. Brian Gill, you are Boswell himself. I suspect that is a role of towering dimensions and quite a challenge for you, I'm guessing.
It's fascinating to revisit. I don't know about you, Brian Monty, but it's fascinating to revisit this after 14 years.
So were you in it the first time around?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Both of them.
We both were.
And in the same similar roles?
Yeah. Same characters.
In that one, I was merely Samuel Johnson. I did not. We had another actor who played the father, and so I was a little more streamlined in that one.
Got it. Wow.
So it is interesting to visit it 14 years later. Some things I am finding that the impulse for how I'm saying and what I'm saying is the same, and some of it is completely different, having lived 14 more years and having acted for 14 more years and experience on the stage. So it is a mix of familiar and fresh, new.
I have to say that Brian Gill, I can't think of anybody that I know who could do it better. This character is a curious mix of boyish, playful. This is not that it is you, Brian Gill, but it's a hard thing to capture. Before we found Brian Gill, we auditioned many people, and it's a really hard combination to capture. The man has many faults, many flaws, licentiousness, naivete. But the thing that the quality that he always has is appealing, which is he's open. He's not defended. And it's a really hard, charming quality to achieve. And Brian Gill just does a marvelous job of encapsulating all of that.
Brian Gill is charming, really?
Extremely charming.
Of course he is.
You get the right coat and wig on him. Yeah,
I look good in period dress.
And the viewers can't see him blushing.
Yeah,
that's right. Very good. So it's not just that this longer play has been scaled back, but
the words
on the page are significantly different, too.
Yes.
Typically, in what way are they different now than they were?
Well, they go on less long. They're compressed. I have written more for the two women, Joan and Lady Fiona. I have made them more of a focus, and I've completely eliminated a lot of some of the other characters. Ancillary characters. There was a husband, there was an actor, there was a this and a that, and it wasn't necessary. And this is that thing that comes from needing to compress, comes the strength of creating a stronger spine in the play.
And that's interesting. It's like you can't just cut words out,
no.
But the words that remain in many cases also have to be changed.
They have to become denser, more spare, and then if you put a flourish in, it stands out more. You can't do as much of that.
Right. Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Money, I want to make sure to ask you about the experience of acting side by side with student actors. There are Parkside students, and there's also a University of Nevada, Las Vegas student in the cast also. Mm-hmm. So have you had extensive experience doing that, and what kind of experience has this been for you?
Well, I first started out as a student. I learned when I first started out in Freeport, Illinois, doing my first plays, acting with older actors and watching them from the wings, trying to see what they did. What did they do when they weren't talking?
Mm.
You know, trying to figure out what their process was. And then as I became a union actor, a professional actor after my training, I must say I've always, and even when I was the younger actor, I've always entered the room feeling that everyone in the room is on the same page. Whether someone has had 4 years experience or 34 years experience, we come in and we're all equals, and we're all going to build this thing on our own, and we're going to acquire the information it takes to make this project work. I still feel that way. And so the two actors that we have in the play, their duties are smaller.
Student actors.
The student actors that we have in the play, they don't have as much to say. And what I see, though, is when we're rehearsing, they are watching.
Hmm.
They are watching what we do when we don't talk.
They're watching the
old-timers.
They are. Sometimes our stage manager says we're not going to be going past page 32 today. So
if you guys want to go.
You can go. And they don't. Mm. They stay. They watch.
Wow.
They're just, this is what they want to do. And it's... there's nothing like watching how actors interrelate, how they work with the director, how the director approaches them. I mean, it's a whole world. Each play is its own world, and they haven't had very many experiences with these kinds of people, just university people, which is valuable, of course.
Sure. Well, and that moment when our stage manager said, you know, we're not going to get past this, you guys can go, as their acting professor, I was very pleased that they
stayed.
I thought, okay, they're either going to split or they're going to do what I hope they're going to do.
Yeah.
And they stayed and watched.
Wow.
Okay, good.
And I have worked not in an academic way, but in a professional way. I've worked with younger actors, and I'm always encouraged in the same way that Brian just said. I'm always encouraged when they do want to stick around, when they do want to watch, when they are curious. Curiosity, for me, is the largest, most important quality that an actor, young or old, can have.
Mm, absolutely. By the way, I don't think we have enough time to explore this as much as I want to, but I would love to hear about how the two of you met. I assume it had something to do with theater.
Indeed it did.
How did you know?
We were in a production of Great Expectations with Next Generation Theater at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, we've been in... maybe four or five shows together. I used to be, I still am an equity actor, though I don't perform much anymore. I have written shows with parts for Brian Money maybe four times, four or five times. I have also directed him, and we have a very easy and rich professional relationship, which I think is really nice.
I feel lucky many times that our aesthetic is similar of what theater is. And when we go see a play, many times our views of what we just saw are the same.
And we've also gotten to the point where, okay, you can like this and I cannot.
That's okay.
And that is true, too.
Absolutely. Well, very good. Well, it's great to hear about this latest in your many collaborations, and what a great project. Let's talk about the Fringe Festival, because I suspect a lot of our listeners don't understand the scope of it or the importance of it. Mm-hmm. First of all, have any of you been there before?
I went last summer. I'd been to Scotland a number of times, but I'd never been to the Fringe. I went once I knew we were going to do this for sure. I went last summer and observed and tried to find, to scope out some venues that would work. Unfortunately, I fell, broke my shoulder, had to come home on day three. But the Fringe is, it's kind of like Summerfest, but for theater. The streets are jammed. And people are hawking their wares by trying to hand you leaflets. They're dressed up. They've posters everywhere. You can't get it. You can't get your poster there long enough before someone else puts theirs on top of yours. It's chaos, but it's like a street fair, a Renaissance street fair. It's very fun. It started in the 50s. The first impulse was the International Fringe Festival, the International Arts Festival in Edinburgh after World War II. It was an event that meant to try to pull together Europe after that terrible, devastating war and represent artists in ballet and music and opera from all over Europe to bring people together. And as an offshoot of that in the late 50s, these little tiny kind of off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway shows started popping up in small venues, and now they're even on the street. Circus acts, juggling acts, a lot of comedy acts, a lot of young people, college actors just out of college, even high school, and then, you know, a few more mature troupes like ours, and then sort of the top of the heap are, you know, the Stuttgart Ballet and the National Opera of Scotland. And so it's a very interesting mixture from high to more popular forms. And I would say we fall somewhere in the middle, but there are actually more than 3,000 productions going on. Wow. It's the largest arts festival in the world.
And how long does it last?
For 3 weeks.
Wow.
We're there really, except for shaving off a day, we're there for basically the whole time.
And how does one get into it? How does one secure this opportunity?
You simply apply, and then you have to pay an entrance fee. It's not anything that you're excluded from. If you choose to do it, you can do it. We happen to know three other people going this year. Mm-hmm. One from the Chicago area, Carthage College, is sending a show over. I don't think anyone in our group has ever been before. Is that true?
I think
been
that's
a part
true.
Of it or even witnessed it.
I think that's true. Yeah.
And I should think especially for instance, the students who are part of this production, just to be abroad and to be in the middle of such excitement. Wow.
I think it can be life-changing.
And I would add that it's very affordable as well. The productions are somewhere between 10 and 16 pounds per play.
Yeah. Mm.
So, that is one of the things that often European arts are committed to, which is access.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And it really, and so you can go, you can spend a week there and still, and it's affordable.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's $15-$20 bucks a pop. Mm-hmm.
Will it be one performance of Boswell?
One a day, 6 days a week.
Oh,
for 3 weeks.
3 weeks. Oh,
yes.
Really? Okay.
Yes. We'll so be running solid for 3 weeks.
First performance August 2nd, and I think we finish on the 24th.
Let's not throw dates out.
Don't look at the calendar, Brian.
Wow.
Yes, there's just one here before we go.
Right.
And to which the public is encouraged to come for free. And then there's, is it 21? 20 or 21 performances in Scotland.
Wow. Well, I'm so excited to hear that. I mean, sometimes events of this nature don't allow that. But in this case, you'll take it over there. You said 3 hours you'll have on the actual stage?
To rehearse, yes.
Wow.
For lights, for figuring out our routes going in and out, it's
Well, and then for performance, we're allowed 90 minutes.
That's the huge challenge.
In and out. To get in, set out, do your show, take it down, get out.
Wow.
We have 10 minutes to take it in and out. That's inclusive.
Wow. So that's another reason to scale it back.
Yes.
But in
yes.
a way that if,
yes.
But in a way that obviously you feel really, really good about. You feel like in this process, it's a better play than it was at the start.
It certainly is a better play. We have to get our training wheels on to make it actually work in the space, but I know we will.
Wow. Very exciting. Well, I hope a lot of people will take advantage of the opportunity to experience this play, Boswell, by Marie Kohler, this coming Saturday, the 27th of July. That'll be at 4:30 in the afternoon in Parkside's Black Box Theater, which is an amazing space where all kinds of great theater has been done. And so again, that performance, free, is this Saturday afternoon at 4:30 in the Black Box Theater at Parkside. And then there'll be some kind of reception following, I think.
Right. There's going to be a reception and then a chance to do a talk back with the playwright and actors.
Fantastic. So what an exciting opportunity that is as well.
And I have great thanks for Dean Walker and for Parkside and for Brian Gill for helping this to happen. It could not be happening without them.
Fantastic. So playwright Marie Kohler, her play Boswell, being performed this Saturday and then at the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, Scotland. Her husband, Brian Mani, is one of the actors in the company of Boswell, as is Brian Gill from the faculty at Parkside. And finally, Dean Leslie Walker, Dean of the College of Arts and Humanities. My thanks to all of you. Very best wishes with your upcoming performance at Parkside and then in faraway, lovely Scotland. We hope all goes well, and I thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Thank
this was
you.
Great.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, the morning show broadcast is going to be preempted by Robert Mueller's testimony on Capitol Hill, which is going to be covered live by National Public Radio. But you can still hear the morning show tomorrow if you subscribe to the morning show podcast. And for tomorrow's podcast, I am sharing an interview from way back in 2002 with Eric Kleinenberg, sociology professor at New York University, a native of Chicago, and the author of a fascinating book called Heat Wave, a social autopsy of a Chicago disaster. It looks back at the heat wave of 1995, in which temperatures reached 106, heat indexes reached 126, and 700 people are believed to have died due to heat-related causes. And Eric Kleinenberg looks back at why so many people died and why they died in particular neighborhoods or why particular sectors of the population were especially vulnerable. It's a fascinating book and a very, very important story. But again, you can only hear that interview via the podcast. And so look on Spotify or Apple Podcast or Google Podcast for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. On Thursday, our broadcast morning show will be back, and it's a really fun conversation I recorded with Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who is conductor of the Carthage Choir, and with three members of the choir, Elena Cressy, Christopher Wojciechowicz, and London Royston, talking about the choir's dual triumph at the Spital Choral Competition in Austria a little earlier this summer, when the Carthage Choir took first place in both the folk division and classical division, an uncommon and impressive achievement. So we will talk with all of them about that experience of being